Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuckadelics? What the fuckleberry thins? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? I'm okay. I saw that film, The Lobster, last night. I talked to John C. Reilly about it, and he was in it, obviously, but thought it was an interesting movie, and I went to see it, and it's sort of a mind fucker. It's serious art film poetry. A lot of things coming at you in a way you've never seen before, and it puts a lot on you to process this abstract, somewhat surreal, but very vulnerable film about something that is not real per se. There's not a lot of commitment to the idea that, you know, whatever culture this is that sends away its divorced or widowed people to a hotel that where they have a certain amount of time to meet other mates before they are turned into an animal. And the only way they can get more time to meet their mates is to go out and tranquilize people who are called loners, people who are off the grid, out in the woods, and bring them in to be, I believe, transformed into animals. I'm not sure. But the flat affectation of the acting and the strange, surreal setting, yet very basic human relationship ideas about relationship dynamics, marriage, are all covered in this, but it's so abstract and so poetic that you just have to sit there and let your brain get fucked by this movie. Today on the show, Terry Reid, the singer-songwriter, who's been around for a long time. I'm not sure that you would know him right away unless you know him. He certainly knew everybody else, but he was around in the 70s. He was one of the great white soul singers out of the UK. Had a record in 68 called Bang Bang, You're Terry Reid, and then another record, self-titled record, in 69. Then an amazing record called The River, called just River, in 73, and a couple of records. He's been recording the whole way through, but the real notorious records are those first three. Then Seed of Memory and Rogue Waves in 78, 79, then a handful of other records throughout 2013. Well, Light in the Attic is issuing. It's not really a reissue. It is a reissue, but it's called The Other Side of the River, and I think it's got a lot of the takes that are on River, but also some alternate takes, and I talked to Terry a lot about these alternate takes that were found. It comes out Friday, May 20th, remastered, and it's got six never-before-heard tracks plus alternate versions of songs from River. You can go check that out wherever you get music. But do check out Light in the Attic. Their stuff is pretty amazing. They do amazing reissues and some original records as well. Great label, Light in the Attic. I will tell you that right now. But Terry Reid, most people know him as the guy that turned down the lead singing position of Led Zeppelin. If you know that story, but he knew everybody. And when I got an opportunity to talk to him, I knew his first three records. And then I was given the new one, these reissues and never before issued stuff from the mid 70s, early 70s to listen to. And it was stunning. And he's around, he lives nearby. Well, he's in California. So I kind of jumped at the opportunity, but he was one of these guys that, you know, had been around England for so long and in the music business so long. He's got great fucking stories of all eras. But I will give you a heads up on this, not a spoiler, but if you're young enough or old enough, or maybe if you're young and interested, I mean, what's the first thing you think about when you hear the name Brian Jones? You think like a Joe, you know, like a genius, like the original member of the Stones that defined their sound, a druggie, a guy who died or maybe got killed in a swimming pool that may or may not, it depends on what conspiracy you decide to believe. Maybe you know Brian Jonestown Massacre, which has nothing to do with Brian Jones, really. But nonetheless, he was a Rolling Stone. He was an original Rolling Stone. And Terry Reid tells one of the best stories I've ever heard about Brian Jones. Not a long story, but you just don't associate a personality per se to Brian Jones. You just associate him with the mythology of the Stones, that he died, that he was difficult, that he was a genius, that he had a drug problem. But he just becomes this person in one line in the story that Terry Reid tells. So look forward to that. You mind if I call my friend Jim Norton? My buddy Jim Norton is going to be out here, I think, yeah, it's like next week. May 26th, Jim Norton will be here in Los Angeles at the Novo. And May 27th, he'll be in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Mirage Hotel and Casino. You can go to jimnorton.com to buy tickets. Jim is one of the most honest, most disgusting, most endearing, most crass and horrible, wonderful little men out there performing comedy. I love him. And I just want to make sure that if there are anybody that is a fan of Jim Norton that listens to this show and you didn't know he was coming, I want to make sure you know he's coming at the Novo here in L.A., May 26th. And let's get him on the phone. I talked to him in New York. He hosted a town hall thing at Sirius where he interviewed me. Did a great job, and I did Opie and Jimmy's show. I enjoyed that. But I love Jim, and I'm going to call him. We're going to call Jim, and we're going to talk to him, and we're going to tell you again when his gigs are. So let me get him on the phone.
Hello?
Jim, are you there? Is that you?
Hi, Mark. It is me. Yeah, I'm surprised this worked out. These connections never seem to work out properly.
Yeah, I find that with all connections of all kinds.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They sound good in theory, and then they wind up being shitty.
Yeah, emotional connections, connections with audiences. It's all touch and go.
You know, it's funny, man, especially with like one-on-one. For you, is it hard to have connection with sex? Like, it's virtually impossible for me to have eye contact during a sexual experience if I care about the person.
Is that true? Because I'm weird. Like, I don't know what it is about me, but I have to not only I have to have full eye contact. I don't really like closing my eyes unless I don't want to come. Like, you know, the only time.
Really?
Yeah, the only time I'm closing my eyes is to, you know, get my breathing in a zone to where, you know, I don't blow my load. But generally, you know, I like to look, I like to feel, I like to see what's happening. I like that. You don't like that?
No, I don't mind looking because it's like I'm kind of a pornographic voyeurism. But I can't be intimate. Like if it's someone I don't know or a stranger or, you know, if we're behind a dumpster, yeah. I can tell her I love her. But if it's like somebody I'm dating or that I care about, it's got to be filthy and I can't look at her. And it really messes me up, man, that the lack of ability to have that connection during sex.
Well, I find that that I have that experience right after sex. It's, you know, don't look at me. We did it. What do you need now?
Oh, so, okay, yeah. The emotional connection is now broken and hit the bricks.
Yeah, the snuggly part, you know, I get a little squirrely with, but the sex part, I like to, you know, be completely engaged. What I do? Are you with somebody?
No, man. I mean, it's literally 5 years. I've dated. I've had a couple of very brief, like, you know, month or two things. But I haven't had like a real girlfriend since 2011, and I'm kind of at a point now where I want a girlfriend, you know, and I'm saying girl in air quotes, you know, just somebody to date regularly.
What do you mean? That somebody that is the illusion of a woman might work out?
Well, yeah. You know, someone who's kind of half there. You know what I mean? Woman, you know, whatever. Just somebody who I get along with and I enjoy having sex with. It would be nice to see them more than once. And I find that different things fuck it up, man. Like, I'll start to like somebody, and then I find one little flaw. It's like I have to find something in order to sabotage it. Like, I mean, I'm sure you know the drill.
I do, but, like, what's a deal-breaking flaw?
It really depends. They're too dirty. They're not dirty enough. Almost like whatever they present I will crave the opposite. Because the deal, I mean, like, bad breath would be a deal-breaking flaw, but it's very rare that you run into that. Somebody who is, here's the one that's the worst, judgmental, like for real judgment, you know, because I'm pretty out there about stuff I've done sexually, and if it's somebody who doesn't know my comedy, and then they start finding out things, and I get that, like, oh, I had one girl tell me, you know, we were having lunch, and she goes, you know, that stuff you told me last night, you can never tell me that stuff again. I mean, I have my idea of what masculine is, and I just can't hear that stuff. And I wasn't even mad at her, but as we're eating lunch, like, I felt every ounce of fucking liking go away. And right. I just was done with her by the time we were finished with lunch.
Well, she basically
so that
just,
will kill it for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, well, she just shamed you in a, like, it wasn't, you know, it's not like helpful advice. It's like, you know, you're not a man to me if you tell me that stuff that you obviously have done in your life.
Yeah, the shaming stuff, because I don't shame a woman about anything.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care. Like, I've had girls tell me that they, you know, they wanted to fuck their dads and all this other great stuff, and some I've had to goad into saying it, but they do. But anything you come out with, I'm okay with. Like, yeah. I'm not going to judge anybody's past. So when someone does it to me, that makes me instantly, like, disconnecting. Oh, fuck you, man. It just, that really is irritating.
Yeah, what I'm having a hard time with, I guess you're a little younger than me, but what I don't always understand after a certain point, like, I'm 52, I got no kids, you know, I've been married twice, I've been through the fucking mill with everything. It's like, I'm not sure what I need right now. Like, you know, what do I really want? Do I want to get married again? No. Do I want someone to live with me? Not really. Do I want kids? No. So what do I really want? You know, like, what, I don't understand what the hell a relationship is good for sometimes.
Yeah, I find it's like being greedy. Like, that's exactly it. I don't know what I want, because I know that there are enough people out there where I can get what I want, especially with Tinder and Bumble and Raya and all these fucking dating apps. It's not for lack of choices. It's the fact that I'm just a greedy motherfucker, and I want everything, and then as soon as I get it, I throw it away, and I want the hunt again of something new. It's like I'm unsatisfiable. It's really pathetic at my age.
Yeah, I think I have a little of that, but I can't, you know, I'm in a relationship, but I can't really, I was never that, you know, that driven to sort of push the envelope sexually. But I do wonder, it's sort of like, isn't sex just sort of enough? I mean, if you don't want kids, you don't want to be married, you're not really capable of trusting people deeply or having real intimacy. Isn't there a point where you're just sort of, I guess this is the way I am. It's not horrible. So I'll just live this way.
Yeah, you know, you start to resign yourself to, like, all right, maybe this is as far as I'm going. This is the best it's going to get.
Yeah.
But I haven't even fucked in a while. Like, my dick's not even staying hard, unless it's an inappropriate thing. Like, it stays really hard through the entire experience. If I'm kissing a girl, my dick is hard through my pants for an hour, and then as soon as it touches her vagina, it's like, whoa, whoa, just panics and hides. So it's like I'm having this real, like, connection thing. Because it's not necessarily a performance issue.
Yeah.
I think it represents something, in, like, you know, a connection or something really nice. And I just, you know, there's a part of me that just isn't having it.
Yeah, you're despite whatever you're thinking, your dick is panicking.
Yeah, it's completely, completely panicking. My dick is acting like it's been shamed. And it doesn't matter who I'm with. It has nothing to do with the partner, yeah, how hot they are, what, yeah, they're willing to do, whether it's loving. You know, it's not about that. Can't seem to fuck lately.
From knowing you and talking to you many times, I can say with confidence that your dick has been shamed.
Yeah, it has been, and in some cases, it should have been. You know, not all shame is wrong. There's certain things I've done that a justifiable amount of shaming was given.
Yeah.
But it's the stuff that I shouldn't be ashamed of,
right,
you know, that I am, that just seems to, it just seems to wreck it for me, and I can't seem to get out of the pattern. Maybe it's because I don't want to. You know what I mean? Like, you know how they talk about, hey, liking lust seems weird? Like, I like being that way, too, and it's just like I'm not willing to stop.
Well, that's something I've been thinking about lately is that, you know, I think my comfort zone is uncomfortable. That like I, you know, I think that the way I brought up, the way I felt as a kid and all that shit, that I generally felt a little awkward, a little uncomfortable. So that's really what I know. So that's my comfort zone. Like, I'm just, you know, an uncomfortable guy in a lot of ways. And you know, to feel comfortable is completely alien and not necessarily something that I can adapt to that well.
And that's the way it is sexually and every other way. Like, The stuff that might have turned me on when I was 15 or made me feel connected when I was 15 is just so far in the past, and my normal level is just so far above where it should be, and it just there's no way to satisfy it.
Yeah, yeah, it's horrible. The ongoing hunger, then the relief, and then the shame, and then the fucking feeling of emptiness, then the boredom, and then the fucking relief again, you know?
The boredom is the worst of all those things. I think the boredom is almost the worst. Because the other stuff, at least, there's like, okay, if I'm ashamed, I know I'm ashamed. If I'm angry, I'm angry. If I'm depressed, but the boredom, there's really no rational explanation for it. That's the one that fucks me up, because I'll go like, all right, she's a nice girl. She eats my ass. She's a trooper. She'll do anything I want. She'll talk any way I want. She'll tell me to wear panties. She'll cuckold me. She'll tell me she loves me. And none of it feels like anything, and I'm bored. So it's like, what the fuck do you want, idiot? She's giving you all this stuff, and you're bored.
I like the list.
Now, believe me, I cut it short. You know, I don't want... There's a lot more on that list of great options. Talking dirty and being, and I talk about sex so much, and I hate that that's my thing, but yeah. it just seems to be the focus of most of my discomfort and my obsession. You know, I just wish I could get out of that mindset sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard. So you do an advice show now too? You do the Opie and Jim show in the morning, and then how often do you do the advice show? What's that called?
Well, it's just the Jim Norton show, and it's once a week. And the reason that came about a few years ago is Sirius gave me a raise, but they kind of wanted, you know how they say you got to work for it.
Yeah.
So they said, why don't we do a music show on the Ozzy's Boneyard channel every night, which you pre-record,
right,
and a once-a-week advice show. So it started as it's a goof. I'm like, all right, I'll just fuck around. Some callers will call in. But then people started calling in with real stuff. Like, it wasn't, it's not that I'm sitting here like some douchey guru. The whole thing started as a goof, but then they'd be like, hey, man, I want to get sober, and I want to do it. Like, they would have, like, legit things.
Yeah.
So I guess it's kind of, everyone understands that I'm flawed, and I tell the truth about myself, so I think people kind of like that, as opposed to being like Dr. Laura,
yeah,
where you're sitting there like this twat on the mount telling everybody what's wrong with them. I kind of come from the same place that you'd probably come from, which is, look, I know I'm flawed. I know I'm damaged. I've learned certain things, and maybe this will help.
Yeah, I'm not a professional, but I went through this, and this helps me.
Yeah, and I think people like that.
Yeah, they
do. I think they like the lack of perfectionism in the advice or the suggestions. And I like a lot of times I'll tell them, I don't know, man, I have no experience with that, and here's what I might do, but I can't be truthful. People like once in a while when you say you don't know, because
sure,
at least they know that you're not coming from a place of being, holier than thou.
Yeah, you can say, I don't know. Maybe let me see if I can get your phone number or look it up, because you're fucked up in a way I don't even understand.
Yeah, and let me see if I can get your phone number. You've actually taken it one step further than I ever.
Exactly.
You've done more work in that than I've ever done. I've always just said Google it. I have no idea what to tell you. People ask about kids.
Yeah.
I don't want to give, like, first of all, if you take Jim Norton's advice with your children, you're fucking ridiculous. Like, my baby's choking. What do I do? Like, dude, I don't have to tell you. You know, fucking call someone who knows.
Better,
I don't know how to handle that.
You better do something quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it depends on how you feel about kids. You might say, wait an hour and see how it works itself out.
Oh, fuck. Well, that's fucking great. So you're coming, you're doing a show here in L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, I L.A. is always a frightening one for me.
What date is that? It's next Friday?
Next Friday, or is it Thursday? I think I'm doing the Novo on Thursday, and I'm doing Vegas, the Mirage, on the Friday. I should probably know my own dates. I understand the value of a plug, and I understand how it's done and how you should be prepared. And I see these guys, they come in, and they have no idea. And I'm like, what dopes? They don't know how to plug. And then here I am. It's May 26th at the Novo. Here I am, and I don't know exactly how to plug. I almost feel embarrassed or ashamed plugging. It's like, especially with a friend. Like, when you're doing it with someone you don't know, it's a disconnected experience. You're like, yeah, these are my dates.
Yeah.
But when I'm talking to somebody I've known for 20 years, it's almost like, and I'm going to be here. And it's just, I don't know how to do it.
Well, you're talking to the right guy. So you're in Los Angeles on May 26th, in Las Vegas, May 27th, JimNorton.com. But I mean, I'm the same way, but now, like, I get this weird thing where, like, I don't ever expect that I'm going to sell out or a lot of people are coming, but I do want the people that I know like me to come. You know, like I don't know how many that number is, but I want to make sure all the ones, you know, that if they're out there and they're you know, not quite paying enough attention. Like, because I get sick of the thing where you got the biggest fans in the world and you promote on every platform available, and then you leave the town and, you know, 2 days later they're like, I didn't know you were coming. It's like, what the fuck do you want me to do?
Yeah, how can
house?
I let every person know individually? Louis' mailing list seems to be the way to go, and I guess if I had one the size of him, that'd be a good way to do it. But I don't know either. I get the same ones. When are you coming to Philly? It's like, I was there 2 days ago, you fucking non-fan. Where were you? You know, there's no way to tell everyone. So I just try to, you know how it is, man. You get out there, you plug as much as possible, and there's so many forms of entertainment. You just hope somebody's interested. And you're right. The ones that show up, I just want them, the people who like me, I want them to know I'm going to be there.
Exactly. And what? How's the material? You feel good about it?
Yeah, I'm going to shoot it at the end of July. You know, it's one of those things. I get so sick of it. And my curse has always been, it's like a little bit too topical, so like a year later, it doesn't feel as relevant. So I'm trying to keep it. You know, I talk about, obviously, Caitlin and my whole opinion and experience in that world, and I'm trying to keep it fairly evergreen so it's not something contingent upon the Vanity Fair cover. You know what I mean? Like, I'm talking about that, and obviously the Trump thing I'm trying to keep very, very something that could be watchable in a year or two.
Well, maybe what you should do is, the last special I did, it was almost all evergreen because, you know, you don't know when the hell people are going to watch it and where they're going to watch it. Maybe you should do a scenario with the Trump thing and do a few jokes as if he's president. See how that
I did think of that. I thought it'd be funny to tell the audience, this is what I'm doing, because I don't know when people are going to watch this, and then do a couple of jokes of Hillary being the president and a couple of jokes of Trump being the president.
Oh, you got to do that.
And just see how it works out.
You got to do
that, or just be lazy and release the special with both, so I've kind of covered, you know, all my bases.
Well, I think it would be funny either way. I think you should definitely do that. Do a couple of jokes with Hillary and a couple of jokes with Trump as president, and then leave them all in after.
Yeah, and just see what happens. And people go, like, well, at least he thought it through. They just got lazy in the edit.
All right, buddy. Well, okay, so May 26th here in L.A. at the Novo, and May 27th in Vegas at the Mirage. I love you, Jim. And
thank you, Mark. I love you, and I'll be out there. I'm actually coming out Sunday, so it'd be nice to see you during the week, maybe in the afternoon if you want to grab some lunch.
Let's do it. Text me.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Mark.
You bet. Bye.
Bye.
Once again, Jim Norton, Los Angeles, May 26th at the Novo, Las Vegas, Nevada at the Mirage Hotel and Casino, May 27th. Always enlightening and relieving, and you know, what's great about Jim is that, you know, you can always pretty much, if you're like almost any person, you know that you're not as bad as you think you are, and you're not handling as much crazy bullshit that you get yourself into as Jim Norton is. And that's why he's so brilliant. Can I just share with you an email about my show? We're now into, we've now burned through 4 episodes of Marin on IFC. It's on Wednesdays at 9. I'll actually plug my Tripany House dates. You can also go to WTFpod.com/tour. I'm doing those Tripany shows at the Steve Allen Theater Tuesdays through June. Get tickets if there are tickets to be gotten. I'll tell you again how proud I am of this season of Marin. I really think we did a wonderful job making a show that is not... it's a cautionary tale. Is it an allegory? I don't think so. I think it's a fictional cautionary tale of how my life could have gone or may still go, God forbid. But people are responding very well to it, and for the right reason, and I'm happy for that. That's the most I can ask for. We did an amazing thing, I think. But I just got this email from Rob. Thanks for this season of Marin. 9 months ago, I had the unpleasant task of driving, in parentheses, dragging my wife to an inpatient facility. I spent a month alone with our kids, holding shit together until she got out. She's doing well, and after a lot of bitter argument, so are we. This season gave us a way to really laugh at addiction and recovery from the clueless, quote, all I need is one shot, unquote, stagger and swagger of relapse to the endless nattering, but still strangely helpful journey of recovery. You nailed the facts while showing that every tragic situation has a pure diamond of comedy within it. Your show helped us laugh at ourselves, and more than anything else, we needed that. Thanks, Mark. Best, Rob. That, to me, is what the show is for. You know, it's like in the world we live in now, I never, ever in my life had any aspiration or illusions that I would be for everybody. And I don't give a fuck that I'm not. But I'll tell you, you know, whatever I am and whatever I've fought to be in any medium I'm in, if it resonates with you, I am glad to connect. And I appreciate the feedback and I'm happy to help out. So look, people. This is a pretty big deal, this interview with Terry Reid, because, you know, I'm not a complete nostalgia freak, but I like people that live the life. I like people that remember the life they lived, and I like people that lived a life in proximity to my heroes or to the people that I always revered. And music is music, and this guy goes all the way back, and it's a pretty stunning interview. As I said before, his new album from Light in the Attic, The Other Side of the River, is available Friday, May 20th. It's remastered, and it has six never-before-heard tracks from this period where he did The River. And there's alternate versions of the song on River. Go check it out wherever you get music. So now is let me bring you my conversation with Terry Reid. There's a type of singing, like, because I was listening to the new record that's coming out on Light in the Attic.
Other Side of the River,
which is outtakes from the River sessions.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And, like, the River, like, I picked up the other day, because I have your first two albums. I have Bang Bang, and I have this self-titled record.
But
someone turned me on to you. I think my girlfriend gave me Bang Bang, and then another kid's like, you got to know who Terry Reid is, right?
No, go.
So I started listening to this stuff. I'm like, holy shit, because there's... You know, there's only like, you know, four of you guys that do that stuff, and you all sort of came out around the same time, like Cocker, right? And like,
well, yeah. Well,
like this British soul
big
singing.
Compliment.
Yeah. Hey, what are you kidding, man? It's great.
Well, everybody was a soul singer in England.
Right? Is that the way it was?
Well, you know, nobody went to see. All the white groups only went to see black groups,
right.
Put it that way, for lack of a
better. Whether they be blues or R&B.
Yeah, more R&B.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, no, the Four Tops.
Where'd you grow up?
Out in the countryside in Cambridgeshire.
So you would go into London to see bands?
Oh, yeah, we'd go anywhere to see. You know, Hammersmith Odeon was where the Four Tops and the Temptations, they always would play there.
And how old were you when you were seeing that stuff?
Oh, like 13.
Really?
Yeah, 14, you know.
And that's what just put it in your head?
We got the records, right? Mm-hmm. So that was it. We were devout. That was it. That's the only way that we heard anything.
Right.
You know, you could get Mary Had a Little Lamb and we'd turn it into an Otis Redding tune.
Yeah. But it's interesting because some dudes, it seems like, you know, if I talk to... You know, if you look at, I guess he's probably a little older than you, but maybe not. But there was a whole other contingent that was doing blues, like the straight up. I talked to John Mayall, you know.
Yeah,
I had Mayall in here.
Very good friend of mine.
Yeah. He's a good guy, right?
Oh, he's a lovely, he's a fantastic guy. See, we all came up in that.
I mean,
I just, you're born when you're born. And then when you get a little older, if you're into playing music.
Right.
It's the time whenever you just fall into that whole thing.
Sure.
You look around.
Yeah.
Or you look around the paper, you look at whatever in the music rags, and you see who's doing what. Well, with me, it was a bit funny because, and some of my mates too, like Robert Palmer and a lot of people.
Palmer, another great soul singer.
Yeah, oh, he's lovely. Yeah. He was a lovely guy, you know. I mean, fantastic songwriter. Mm-hmm. But we were all devout R&B guys. And when you'd look around and when we were all at school, and none of us had a clue that we'd end up in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
But just by when it was, that early 60s thing,
mm-hmm.
we suddenly looked around and we were playing and we were on the road and doing this and things started.
Who was
happening.
Your first band? What was the lineup? What was the first band you were in? How old
first
were you?
First band, I was like, 14, 15.
Playing guitar and singing?
Playing guitar and singing.
So you're always a guitar player?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always play guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, not that well at the time, but, you know.
Yeah.
You got to learn somewhere.
Sure, sure.
But the funny thing was, it was like 13 and 14, and we had a local group out in the countryside called the Red Beats.
The Red Beats.
You know, we all got one.
Did you dress up the same way? Yeah. Oh, you have matching outfits?
Well, little red, little sparkle, you know, like little glitter. Not too much.
Yeah, no, yeah.
We hadn't got the platforms or anything.
Yeah, right.
You know, but that's
they were coming.
It went that way for some, you know. But I was never glitter.
Yeah.
It's not exactly
my thing, right.
So we all get into it. Mm-hmm. And then I joined a band in London called Peter Jane the Jaywalkers. That we'd be supporting all these different groups around.
Who was around them? Because I talked to, who did I talk to? Well, I talked to Lemmy and I talked to Richard Thompson and, you know. And
Lemmy's a big Beatle fan.
Huge Beatle fan.
Hugest Beatle fan in the world.
Yeah, and he'd go see everybody, you know.
Yes.
And I'm a huge, I'm sort of borderline obsessed with Peter Green. So anyone's going to talk about Peter Green, you know, I'll listen, you know. But it always amazes me that London It's one city, and all this shit was happening.
Yeah, but you see, not everybody came from London.
But they were there, right?
Well, all roads led to London. Even right. with the Beatles, they were just dying to get out of Liverpool anyway. Which right. is, when you go, yeah, I mean, it has a sort of a nostalgic thing for me.
Sure.
But
did you see the Beatles?
No, I never saw the Beatles.
Well, you guys were almost contemporaries, right? Not quite about?
No, they were, see, the older? Beatles were the ones that set the stage sure, for sure. what we all love to do.
Sure,
now,
right.
He's a bunch of guys yeah. from where? Liverpool?
Oh, right.
And they wrote these songs?
Yeah.
Are you joking? No. This is some good stuff here. What's going on? They're from Liverpool. Yeah, now they're in London now.
Right,
and they're
right.
making all these records. And they're just fantastic.
Right? Right.
And everybody wanted to be in a group then.
Yeah, right.
And write their own material thing. Whether they could or not, that's not the point.
So you were writing material early on, right at the beginning?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing, I was trying to scratch my head one day, what was the first thing I wrote?
Yeah.
Which, that writing thing, I'm not quite sure what that means. You know?
Right, it's right. Like, how do you write a song?
It comes out of thin air or something.
Right,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Being musical and that from an early age and that, I was like a sponge with tunes anyway.
Yeah.
So something comes up and you put this together with that and voila, you end up with a story with it and it's a song.
Right.
You know, I don't think you really write it.
Right.
All that sitting down diligently and I mean, I've done that with songs.
But sometimes it just comes to you, you got your
it
notebook and you get write a
yeah,
phrase.
I got a tune
yeah.
and I put words to it. And
yeah.
Back.
Yeah, and that's
and
the way it goes.
There's one song with that expression that I did on that early albums that you were talking about.
On Bang Bang or the other one?
I think it's on Bang Bang.
Yeah, which yeah. song?
It's called With That Expression.
Yeah, yeah.
That was probably the first thing that I got pen to paper and did something, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's gone around all over the place.
Sure,
right?
man. Those were big records. That Bang Bang was a big record, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't just that. It's yeah. a good friend of mine, Graham Nash. He did it with
right.
with the Hollies,
mm-hmm.
which I never knew right. about for years. And then he did it with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, right?
Yeah.
Right? And then John Mellencamp did it, right?
Nice.
And then there's all these people did it, and I thought, well, what about the rest? Do a few more, right? No. I mean, to me, Crosby, Stills, and Nash doing one. I mean, you've only got, like, what, 4 or 5 great writers in the band who have got 50 songs each, you know?
Yeah.
Just
flattering, right?
Me, right?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Like, even listening to the first records, they're sort of like, they're very lyrical stuff, and they do, but they all seem to have their own tone, and I couldn't quite place it. It's pretty uniquely yours. I mean, I guess early on, there was, you know, a sort of the way kind of like maybe Van Morrison wrote stuff, where things just kept moving, you know, and you yeah. just kept singing over it.
Well, though, Van, I must admit, at a very, very early stage, you know, I remember when he was with a group called Them.
Them, yeah.
Yeah. I remember back then. See, we all grew up in this thing.
So you would see them.
Yeah.
They'd be around. The Hollies would be around.
Right. Yep. And we'd be like the backing group, backing all these groups, the Animals.
You would play or you were the opening
band?
We'd
play the opening band.
You were the opening band with the J. What was the name of your band then?
Peter J and the Jaywalkers.
Yeah.
Right. It's the best education you ever had because not only not what to do, but to figure out, well, what is it that they're doing to get it so right?
Right.
The Hollies puzzled me to hell. Graham caught me one day. I was after the gig. I'm behind the curtain,
yeah.
behind their amps.
Yeah.
And I'm looking around.
Yeah.
Right? You know,
yeah.
behind the amps.
Yeah.
He says, what are you doing? I says, well, you can't sound that good. You've got some other stuff yeah. behind there. I don't know about. He's going,
there's some magic somewhere.
He said, that's what? God.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
He said, that's flowering. And do you know what?
Yeah.
He didn't have anything.
Nothing.
Nothing. Just straight amps.
Yeah. Well, who the hell knows what the...
That's depressing.
But who knows what the magic is, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was them. I mean, they were unbelievably good live.
What were you about to say about Van at that point? Because
Van always had a very, very distinctive style.
Yeah.
Singing wise.
Yeah.
If you listen to things, he even listened to Gloria.
Yeah.
Which was them.
Yeah.
And you listen to things he sings now. Don't get me wrong. It's exactly the same. His phrasing.
Yeah.
Is definitive.
Yeah.
Him,
right, 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 right.
And you can't put your finger on, well, where did he get it from? All that thing. No,
right.
It's a total blend of everything he likes, which
yeah.
is what I always say. He's never one favorite singer.
Yeah. And were you guys friends?
We know each other real well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Van's a character to behold, I'll tell you, you know.
Always?
Yeah, well, he don't take prisoners, put it that way, you know.
Was he always like that?
He's always been that way. He's very short, short with words and things with people. And that, but we know each other real well.
But that's interesting about vocalists is that, you know, it's really on you guys to, it's all going to be in the phrasing. It's all going to be the interpretation and the honesty of your own voice. So you're going to find it or you're not, right?
It's what fits your, it's like I always say as well, when people go into studio, they say, oh, that's a nice mic. I'll use that.
Yeah.
Over the years, you discover that there's the right mic for a certain singer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, what is right for one singer will not necessarily work on another singer.
Right.
There's always one.
What's now, your mic?
There's two. There's a couple of different Neumanns that are great if you're singing softer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're slamming it and you really, like this thing with
belting it out. Right?
Yeah. You got to be careful. A ribbon mic is usually the best. Now, my favorite mic on that kind of thing is a BX-44.
Yeah.
The big RCA mic.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, it's the best because it's warmer and the ribbon moves.
Oh, so you can belt it out and it won't blow it up?
When you belt at it, it doesn't smack you in the face.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like that digestive ad on TV, you know, when a hamburger beats you up, right? So you have to really learn over years of what's the right mic because you know right away when it isn't when you listen back.
But when you were coming up, like when you're, because your guitar playing is pretty unique as well. You know, like especially those first few records that I have, like it's really kind of honest and, you know, it's got a little bit of distortion to it.
It was a bit funky then, and then it turned into something else. It turned into a rhythm thing. When I got to like River and then when it got to See the Memory, later on albums.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that, there's one particular man that I didn't want it to influence me that much.
Who?
Was Richie Havens.
Oh, really?
I got to know him real well, and he was so gentle and so nice. And he's one of them guys that will sit down with you and show you things.
Yeah.
That
he played open tuning, right?
Oh, my God. Did he? He got all sorts of raga tunings.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah. Because, like, you would see he'd be going, and you're like, he only using one finger on the fretboard.
I know.
And his thumb. Right, and his thumb coming over the top.
He showed me how you can turn this chord into that chord. Backwards and forwards and things. And I went,
wow.
What's that all about?
Yeah, yeah.
And drop D and then into different open tunings and then one with two octaves and all these different things. And then for a while I thought, that's nonsense.
Yeah.
I can't do that. It's too much. And then as a couple of years went by, for some reason I didn't forget it.
Yeah.
You know when you like something, you remember it?
Sure, and you integrated
it? Got in there in my whole thing, in my head. And that ruined me.
Oh, really?
There was all sorts of tunings there.
Yeah.
And that work from.
And that opened you up.
Yep. Opened me right up. And because you're writing a song, or like I say, whatever, you're working on something, and you think, it doesn't work in this key.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't work in this tuning. Or it doesn't work. And you move around. So I have a row of guitars in different tunings. And then as I'm trying to figure out where to put it, I'll go from guitars and then I'll go, now it's a lot easier in that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it all just to sing and play. Together. So that's a whole, over the years and that is something you sort of develop. It's a strange way of going about things, but.
Well, it's interesting because, when I talked to Keith, he just used that one open tuning. He uses that, what is it, an open G?
Open G with the bottom off. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And there's part of you that thinks like, well, you lost a string, how is that better? But it's because there's a tone that's available that you're not going to get with a straight tuning.
Well, it's not just that. It's looking at it like a banjo or a uke.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of people that are good on ukulele, a four string, can get all sorts of inversion of chords out of them.
Yeah, yeah.
From, all different positions. Hobie Carmichael days.
Sure, sure.
There's some amazing things when it was the norm.
Right.
And then the G tuning, which is sort of like an upside down banjo tuning, really. The high string, right?
Right.
So, and then keep.
Yeah, he can pull it up on it.
So he plays backwards.
Right? Yeah, pulls up on it.
I learned a lot from him, watching him, I mean, I toured with him like twice.
Really?
Yeah.
What years?
Well, like we were saying, that group I was in and things, suddenly you find yourself in the middle. Well, suddenly we were playing a club in London with Peter Jay and that. And I didn't know that Mick and Keith were there. But anyway, they're looking for somebody to open up for their tour in 1965.
Oh, early.
And you weren't kidding. So we got elected.
Yeah.
I got elected on that. And then I end up, I'm on the tour.
Yeah.
A few days later.
Yeah.
So from being on this side and loving it all so much and everything, suddenly I'm right in the middle of it.
Right.
But it wasn't as musical as that people think. You couldn't hear a bloody thing, right?
Oh, really?
Screaming, you know.
Oh, because of all the
girls.
It was
like the Beatles to it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Oh, it was pandemonium out there.
Oh, wow.
Police and cops.
But when you go on, how'd the girls, were they
well,
like,
they scream at anything. What are you about? Anything that moved on the other side is screamable.
Well, it was all opening up then. It was all new. Yeah, this is the beginning.
It was. I'm not sure what, I mean, of course, when the Stones come on, it was pandemonium.
But if you're talking like 65, I mean, like you got to figure rock and roll really came about, what, in the late 50s? So it's only a few years old.
Yeah.
So, and this is a whole new British version of it. So they're the first.
And Elvis never came to England.
Right.
You never played in Colonel Parker. I never could figure out what that was all about.
I wonder what that's about.
So anyway, what was happening in England, you had a whole series of people.
Yeah.
Oh, is he coming in? No, he ain't going to come.
Right,
no,
you ain't going
to get Elvis.
Oh, Elvis, right.
So
right.
You had a whole bunch of really good, actually good singers, like Billy Fury and Marty Wilde and all, but and then Cliff Richard, who was...
Cliff Richard.
Well, he's a tame version of Elvis. Elvis is on fire.
Yeah.
You watch Elvis now and you go, whoa.
Holy shit, still.
Yeah, it still puts my hair up.
And just a singer, too. That's what's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I think what it is, Elvis, is just you can see right through that. He's just a real nice guy.
Yeah, I think so.
You'll never hear anybody say a bad word again.
Almost fragile in a way somehow.
Yeah, very fragile. Yeah, that's what got him.
Yeah. I think that's what gets everybody.
Yeah, that's what gets you. Can't be too nice in this business, you know.
That's why Keith is still alive. It's not going to get him.
Oh, no. That ain't fragile, no. Well, you can spell it different. It might come out, you know. Yeah.
So you were opening, you opened for them, you opened for the Stones, you opened for the Hollies.
Yeah.
And when did you go out on your own and make your own band and do those?
Well, a bit later, that was 65.
And what do you, you learned from Richie Havens, but did you sit down with Keith? Did you ever sit down with other guys and trade tricks?
Really? Just messing around in a dressing room, but there's never really much time. Nothing, you know, Richie Havens I spent hours with him because he would sit for hours showing me things and I thought, haven't you got something better to do? Oh, yeah.
What year was this like? Around late 60s?
This was early 60s.
Early 60s?
Yeah, this was 60.
Wow.
66.
No kidding. And he was in England.
Yeah, but I remember it implicitly. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I called him because I was a real big fan of his and everything. He said, come on over. I went, ooh, now what am I going to do?
So that must have because in your brain, because like I said, there's something interesting about the records, your records, in that, you know, it doesn't matter if there's a chord progression, and some of the chord progressions are a little odd and a little minory, right? And
that's a good way to put it.
But Richie could play one chord all the way through.
Yeah, sometimes. But he also could play many different things.
Yeah, yeah.
There was him, and it was him, and one of his best friends is a guy, I'm not sure if he's around. I mean, I would love to think he was, called Sean Phillips. And Sean Phillips, they all came out of this whole thing of this whole eclectic sort of musical.
It was like world music,
Before world music.
Right, right.
You
right.
got it. Actually, I wish I'd said that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they all were on a plane on their own.
Right, right. Really. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were drawing from all this intellectual world music, as you say.
How did you find that stuff?
Well, I would say I'd listen to what they were listening to going, I've been on the wrong track here. What's going
really?
On?
Really? Like what?
So like the Bulgarian State Chorus, the Sofia District Choir.
So you move from R&B, you're like, there's
I got more R&B.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you couldn't get the records easily in England.
Right.
So once I started meeting people that had been to America bringing things back, you know,
right.
I mean, then I went gung-ho and I could get the things I wanted.
Right.
But the other side of me was like the choirs of... Bulgaria and Romania and Russia and things like that, which are all quarter tone, eighth tone, 16th tone. You know, it's very it was eclectic music, right?
Yeah.
You know? And the thing is of listening, like, you have to really get an ear for it. You have to immerse yourself into it. You can't. Usually the cat will leave the room.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's
like
one of them deals, right?
Right.
But if you listen to it over a period of time and start to understand some of these things, you develop an ear for it.
Right.
Whereas
right.
it's very pleasing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It becomes pleasure, and then you take it on in some sense.
Yeah. Right.
That
sure.
Makes sense.
No. Of course, it makes sense. It gets integrated into your sensibility.
Then you realize when you start getting a little more educated about jazz and different things, and people like Coltrane, Miles Davis, to mention only two, or Ornette Coleman, just three. Then you listen to what. You see how all that, that's where they're coming from.
Right.
They're coming from...
something primal almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, all they, and Duke Ellington would say in interviews, he would say, they'd say, well, you're the man of American music. Where's your influences? He said, well, I just listen to folk music.
Yeah, yeah, right.
End,
right.
End of script, right? Yeah. And go figure that one out, right?
Yeah, because that's the, that is the template.
That's the template.
For
see?
All of it.
It's a template for all of it.
Yeah.
So it's lovely if you can open your mind up and get an ear for things
that
are not necessarily the norm. But you'll find most of all the people that you know, even Keith or Mick Jagger or any of the guys in this whole rock and roll thing, when you get down to the bottom of what some of their influences are, they're astonishingly different than what you thought they might be.
That's right? True. Yeah.
They don't just sit around listening to blues records every day, you know, it's not like that.
No. Because I noticed, like, on some, I don't remember which album it was, I think it might be The River, there's a couple songs where the chord progressions are, like, they're really interesting and unusual. I can't remember which song I'm talking about, but it must have something to do with all that stuff going on.
Well,
your
there's
head.
One at the end called Milestones, which is based upon, like, Gregorian chants and that whole thing I was just telling you, the Bulgarian stuff. Not that I'm that good at it.
No, but you make it your own.
I say, you know, I mean, but...
Yeah. And when you were doing all this work, were you more concentrating on the singing or on the playing? Was it like, you know...
I don't like that concentrating thing, you know? I mean,
yeah, sure.
If it comes naturally...
But do you sit and sing without a guitar?
Yeah, I could...
Sure.
A lot of people, a guitar player, singers, you know, you take the guitar away and they stand like that, you know. It sort of looks a little odd, right? That never sort of, I don't know, that never really bothered me.
Right.
I just get silly at that point.
Right.
And start making silly moves and waving my hands
around. Yeah.
And then they say, give him a guitar again. Really.
Yeah. So, all right. So you're taking all this shit in with Richie and you're opening the band. So, when do you make the transition?
Okay, so what happens? We do, at that time we did that Stones tour, which is like, I thought we were, I was going to say.
65,
yeah,
66.
Yeah, I had my birthday on the tour.
Really?
That was hysterical.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember much of it, to be honest with you. It was all just like, it just all went by.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we did that. And then we started doing multiple gigs on the back of that.
Yeah.
And then we toured.
Opening gigs.
Yeah, we toured with like Jethro Tull. We toured with the Beach Boys.
Really?
Yeah, and the Small Faces, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that
was great because Marriott became a great fit. You know?
Right. Well, there's that sort of line of that British soul singer. I mean, you and Marriott.
Oh,
and,
we met each other, right? And he says, oh, Terry, we're going to have a good time on this tour.
Did you go up and sing with him? Did you guys sing together?
No,
never?
Not when they were playing.
Right, but
know?
Yeah, but just having a good time?
We had a riot.
Hell of a singer, right?
Unbelievable.
Marriott?
Yeah.
Wow.
But the funniest guy, them guys
really?
Were just like a bunch of, you know, I couldn't figure out where they got the name Small Faces until they walked in the first night, and not one of them's over 5'4". I thought, God, this is like the Yellow Brick Road all over again. What the hell's going on? You know?
Now, did you open for Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, I did. We did a couple of gigs, but Fleetwood Mac's gone through many transitions.
No, but like the first one, did you have you were with Peter?
Yeah, with Peter.
Now, what was he like, dude?
He was very quiet, and he was very to himself, you know?
Yeah.
He was a great guitar player.
Oh, my God. You know? What a real heartbreaker.
Yeah, I know. I know. He was great, you know?
And yeah.
Like, you know.
And John and Mick were fun, I bet, right?
Oh, God, well, you know, Mick Fleet was...
Oh, yeah.
Just
a
total lunatic, right? He comes from the lunatic fringe.
Yeah. And you opened for Cream as well?
Well, that came next, you see. What happened was there was a whole thing going on. We've been touring and touring and touring.
Yeah.
And we're, how would you say, we're on the chart.
Yeah.
Right? And
did you get some hits?
No, we never. Most of my records weren't released. They escaped.
Oh yeah,
I'm not really sure what that's about.
Yeah.
That's why we're finding them now.
Yeah,
you know. Now is what happened was Eric heard about us going around. Yeah. I knew Eric from John Mayall and all that. And I knew Ginger Baker as well. And Jack.
Oh, what was he like? He was a
Ginger. Well, yeah. Barrel of monkeys, I tell you. But you see, some people are where they are. You take them as they are.
Sure, of course.
You know, you were going to change Ginger. Even try.
Yeah,
it could
get
dangerous. You know?
Yeah.
We had mutual friends in that. So
right.
I had another band together by this time, which is just three-piece, a Hammond organ with bass in it, and me on guitar singing and drums. And
no bass player, just an organ?
No, it was keyboard bass, and we wired the lower level of the Hammond into
like
bass
the
bass.
Doors.
So, yeah, well, sort of, but not that different.
Right, different, yeah.
So we end up playing with the Doors a lot. And anyway, but not to get off. So the next thing is that Eric heard about this, and they were going to come over and do their. By this time, Cream had worked its way out. You know, I mean, they were all done.
Yeah, they've had
that enough. We don't talk to each other now. That's it. Right. And Eric's hanging out with George Harrison most of the time, anyway. So they went off and did. Eric did Delaney and Bonnie, and he did a bunch of teas, and Dave Mason and George in there, and it's all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And Cream sort of was going to, they were going to do
Blind
one
Faith
more tour.
Was that Blind Faith? Was
and Blind Faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That didn't work.
Yeah.
No. So they went off and they did one more tour in the States here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Eric called and said, do you want to do the tour?
Yeah.
I said, well, who else is on it? You know, because usually at that time, like with the Stones and things, you have like four or five acts on.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
And he said, oh, nobody. I said, what do you mean nobody? He said, well, just the three of us and the three of you. And I went, well, that's six.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I meant how many bands, you know, there's only six people.
Yeah.
You know? And they're doing stadiums, right? We did Madison Square Gardens, right? I'm saying, they sure about this, you know? And he goes, absolutely, Terry. Yeah, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, we're on that tour.
Wow, just you and Cream.
Just us and Cream.
And it's Terry Reid, that's the name of the
just
band?
Just Terry Reid.
Oh, my God.
It was, Jesus Christ. And I'd heard about this Madison Square Garden. So I'd seen some good fights there on TV.
Sure. Yeah.
Muhammad Ali and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we end up getting there and go to sound check and things, and I go, nearly fall over backwards looking up at the scene.
Right.
It's just phenomenal.
The biggest room you ever played.
Oh.
At that time.
You know,
yeah.
Right. And I go, oh, Jesus Christ, this is unbelievable. Then when we walked onto the stage, they don't do that anymore, but it was the stage was where they had the boxing ring
in the middle
of the place.
Right.
And I walked on there and you get this very funny feeling that you're standing, not in the shoes.
Yeah.
You're standing right in the spot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Where the greatest.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Where all these people. And you the get fighters. A real tingle about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? I said, Eric, God. Was he over here or over there when he hit Sonny Liston? He was over there. he said, boy, do you feel that one?
Like, yeah.
It's just...
Love the
it's
fights.
It's very easy. Oh, well, you know, I mean, they were real fights.
And they weren't known for a music venue as much yet.
No.
Yeah.
No, not at all, you see.
It was all fights.
No,
that's funny. So you're like, you were in awe of the fact that, you know, Sonny Liston and Ali had it out there.
You could almost get a picture and double image it, right? You know, as long as you didn't get hit, you know.
right. So how was those gigs?
Fantastic. It was unbelievable.
Sold out?
Yeah.
I mean, Madison Square Garden?
You have to be tough. Like, you can't be sort of a nice guy with them sort of gigs, you know, because people are all going, cream.
Oh, yeah.
So, look, it came halfway through one song or something.
So you were fighting. Yeah, you had a fight.
Actually, you got a good point there.
Yeah.
I got halfway through and said, now look, stop the band. Okay, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Look, they're not even in the building. Oh. I said, they're never here early. I said, they won't be here for another hour.
So shut up and let me play.
I said, so it's up to you. Yeah. I said, now, there's two things we can do. I can either just...
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah.
I can either split and not play if that's bugging you too much, right? And you can get a bit of peace and quiet, you know? Or... I don't know what. I said, the only problem is with that that I have is if I do that and leave, they won't pay me.
Right.
I said, so
help me out here.
So come on, help me out here, right? And it's New York City, yo.
Right, yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so
right.
Of course everybody, Terry, yeah,
oh, really?
Joe, suddenly I get standing ovation.
Oh, that's
go,
great.
But that's New York. If you just stick up for yourself.
Look at that. You took a couple jabs in Madison Square Garden, and you got it.
Hey.
And they listen.
And they, well, it's 40,000 people, so I forget how many it was. It's
yeah.
Too many to count.
Right. And you got to play what? What'd you do, like 45 minutes?
Yeah, we did 45 minutes. It was tough, you know. And then after that, we working with Cream, we did a bunch of different gigs around the West Coast and did the Forum, and we did Florida and, Atlanta or something. We did it, Philadelphia Spectrum we did as well. Anyway, we did a bunch of them. Then all the festivals that were going on.
Uh-huh. Right? How was Eric, though? Was he a good guy?
Eric?
Yeah.
God, love this guy in the world.
Yeah. Good guy.
It's like nothing's going on.
Yeah.
I'm going, how can you be so calm about all this? You know, it's pandemonium going on.
It might have been drugs at that time.
Yeah, well.
It's a little relaxed.
It don't help all of it.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
Can make you twitchy too.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. But he was laid back.
Just,
huh?
Yeah, Eric's just, they're all, you see, the thing is, I'm very, how would you say, humble, that to get to work early on, you know, as a kid, working with some of these finite, professionals.
Sure. Did you remain friends with him?
At this rock and roll
game. Yeah, sure.
It's not like a business job.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a whole other job. And I'm very lucky to have sort of, followed peers like, Keith and them.
But it's interesting, though, when you talk about those guys who are singular, like when you work with them and as a guy who plays as well and obviously as a fan and a peer, I mean, when you watch Eric or you watch Keith at these different times, did you feel the presence of how special they were, even though you knew them?
Like, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, let me answer that. Yeah, it's they wouldn't have got where they got to
right
when I first read about them, or we first read about them, and all that. You think, well,
how good can they be,
I don't
right?
know how good they can be.
Yeah.
I know, I like that one. I didn't like that song or whatever.
You know, right.
You start
right.
being opinionated.
Right.
But when you see them, you see the magic happen.
Right.
You see
right.
how. You know, the Stones, for instance, like, that first show was with Brian Jones in the band.
Sure.
Which is a totally different band than it is now. It was like a rhythm band.
Right, right.
With him. He was a great rhythm player.
Yeah.
And you'd stand in the wings and listen and you go, what are they doing? How can he do that?
Really?
And A, how can they hear anything and keep it all together and be in tune?
Uh-huh.
They would just, they just roll and they go on instinct and they would do phenomenal.
Right.
And later on, then when Mick Taylor joined, who was also, he was with John Mayall and he was a good friend of mine then. Then when he joined, it was a whole other
ball game. Different band.
Total different theory.
Those Mick Taylor records are great records.
Oh, Honky Tonk and all
that. Yeah, that's all him.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
all the bending and all that stuff. He's phenomenal.
And on Love You on Get Your Yayas Out.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Holy shit.
Here we go. Get Your Yayas. I went on that tour in 69.
You did?
Yeah, I did that one.
Wow.
They called me up and said, hey, Terry, we're going out again. Do you want to go? I'm going, uh-oh.
Yeah.
40 cities or something, you know.
And you did all of them?
All of them. Well, yeah, except Altamont.
Yo, you skipped that one. Altamont?
Well,
you didn't?
Keith says, are you going to Altamont? And I said, well, I'm real tired, you know.
And was it really just that? Or did you know there was going to be trouble?
No, we all got winded. Keith says, I don't particularly want to go myself, but I suppose I have to.
Why? Because you heard that the
oh, no, it was a mess two days before.
Like what? How?
Oh, there was guns going off.
Oh, really?
Because
it was a festival, right? So was there any...
Well, it was a festival with non-festive activities, you know. The Angels were going nuts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so
and I'd always got on really well with the Angels. We did a lot of festivals, the Atlanta Festival.
Yeah.
About 5-6 of Miami.
So they were involved with security at a lot of places.
Bill Graham got them involved with security.
Right.
And
and then
paid them with things they had too much of.
Right, right.
And which so that's they were running anyway.
Right, right.
No. And I don't know what it was. At first it started. I'll tell you how it started. This is true. Is we'd fly into San Francisco.
Yeah.
And the freight department would take all your equipment.
Right.
Your amp, like that one over there. Right?
Yeah.
And that guitar.
Yeah.
Take everything, right? And you get to the gig and half of it's missing. And you go, and you start, you know where that you're looking at people.
Yeah.
What did you do with it? You're acute, and they ain't got it.
Yeah.
Right? You're paying them. What? Right. So this started going on, and Bill says, there's a rat in a drain pipe here somewhere. Right?
Yeah.
And he goes, now they'd heard rumors, so we investigate the whole thing, and there's a big payola thing going at the freight department. Mm-hmm. They got all the numbers on Fenders and Les Pauls,
oh,
the
really?
Real ones.
Yeah.
And they're selling them off.
Shit, so you lost good shit.
I lost a couple of amps.
Yeah.
But some big groups, you know, with the stacks and the Marshalls and things. It was, you know, this cabinet. They didn't take all of it because that's too suspect.
Right.
When but the just truck a few turns things. Up, you're missing about six, four amps. And,
holy
and all
shit.
The bigger groups had a lot of backups.
Yeah, stuff, yeah, right? Yeah.
And it got wicked. So Bill says, I got it. You know what we do? I'm going to get the Angels down here to with all the bikes and the trolleys and trucks and pick up the gear from freight and take it up to Mill Valley and put it in their buildings with the bikes.
Right, to protect the amps. They well, figured that they'd scare the freight carriers.
Well, they got dogs up there that look like no ears and you know, one leg, you know. I mean, you're gonna go in there and steal an app, you're out of your mind, right?
Right.
They got guns, God knows what. Yeah, yeah. Never got one thing sold for the longest time after that.
I mean, it
all went chill, right?
So that's why he brought him in.
So it started, that's years before, when we're doing the Fillmore East and Fillmore West.
So by 69, things were getting out of control.
It got totally out of control.
Yeah.
What it was at that time, the Oakland Angels and that, felt a sense of meaning. Because let's look at it. A lot of them guys, God bless them, were in the war.
Yep.
And they never got their dudes, you know, they never got treated how they should have been treated. Yep. They came back with a real proverbial hair, you know, where, right?
Yeah.
They're pissed off with the whole system, right? Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, I really don't blame them, you know?
Sure.
And they just got angry against society, which had really screwed them.
Right.
You know? So Bill gave them a little self-meaning again, which I thought was a great thing in the beginning. But all good things come to an end.
It
got ugly. It just got real bad.
And Bill Graham in general, you work with him a lot?
Yeah, hell of a lot. I did Fillmore East in New York, probably 15, 20 times.
No shit.
And Winterland and Fillmore West, 10, 15.
Was he a solid guy?
Huh?
Good guy?
Yeah, he loved to shout and scream at you and accuse you for something that you might do.
Yeah.
No, he's just a very angry guy, but he don't necessarily mean it.
Like
5 minutes later, he's just fine.
Yeah.
After we did the tour.
Yeah.
I get a call in England. I was still in England, right? And at my house up there, and Mick Jagger called up and said, look, I tell you what, we've been going through all their tapes, you know, sorting out another 4,000, right? And we found all these master 16 track tapes of the Madison Square Gardens gig when we did that.
Yeah.
Do you want them?
Yeah.
I said, well, for really? That's great. You know, I said, well, he said, no, well, I'll just send them up. So he sent them up in the van.
Yeah.
And I still have them tapes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never mixed them down.
Well, get Light in the Attic to do those too.
Well, you know, it's only a matter of money.
I think it's your time, man. Terry, it's your time.
Every man got his price.
Yeah. I tell you, you know, because like, you know, I don't know, like when I hear you and I listen to you and the extensive fucking work that you did on the road with all these guys and all the fucking playing and all the fucking sweat and skill you put into this stuff.
Oh, like you can laugh. I've been trying not laughing. Yeah. You can swear, and I haven't sworn once yet.
You can swear.
Oh, fuck it.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not on radio, but like, they're like when I listen to this, you know, when I got turned on to your stuff, which wasn't that long ago, I was like, holy shit, this guy is like the real guy. And now, like, you know, this beautiful record that Light in the Attic is going to put out is a beautiful record, even if it's outtakes, but it got me to the river itself, to the album.
Yeah, you go.
And it's a new experience for me because I didn't grow up with your work. And a lot of people in this country I know, like, they're like, you know, who is this guy?
Yeah, right. You
know. And maybe this is it.
Ah, you know. it all confuses me. I just, the point is, I always say, and a lot of my friends that we've talked to me and say, look, if you hang into the game, if you believe in what you do and you love what you're doing, do it.
Yeah.
If you don't love it and don't believe in it, get the hell out of Dodge.
Right, sure.
Don't even go there because You won't stand, you know. It'll drive you nuts, you know. I still got bullshitters call me up with, boy, have I got a deal for you.
Really?
You know, oh, my God. You know how many bullshitters there are in this business?
In music, yeah.
And they're very calculated at how they get you thinking that there's something really going on. And I said, look, you got any money?
Yeah.
And that shuts them fuck right up. Yeah, I mean, that cuts right to the bone. Well, yeah, I got money. Where is it?
It's coming.
So you want to do all this, you want to do that, I tell you what.
Yeah, give me some money.
This is what's going to cost you for me to listen to it, right?
Yeah. Okay.
You got to put your foot down sometime.
But like when I listen to you, like I hear like, you know, the one thing that came to me is like, I got to think that Paul Rogers must have just listened to you constantly.
Oh, you ain't gonna like that, right? I know Paul. I know Paul real well. He was in a band in Newcastle.
Free?
Before that. And the funny thing happened.
Are you guys there? Is he younger than you, though?
Yeah, he's younger than me. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's quite a bit younger than me. I mean, he must be about, 6-7 years younger
than
me.
But it feels to me that you influenced.
Well, yeah, he comes from that Otis Redding thing, too, you see.
Right.
But he was in I forget the name of the group. I'm trying to rack my brain. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was playing up there, and we did a gig together.
You did?
With his band and my band. Yeah. And I thought, fuck me, this guy. Oh.
He can sing, right?
He can sing, yeah. Right? And I happened to be talking to a gentleman who was a very good friend, still is, right? Called Chris Blackwell, the manager, right? Uh-huh. And he's, you know, with Island Records and that, right? And I said, now, I saw this singer up north, you know, bugging me. I said, I'll tell you, Chris, he can really belt it out. He's the real deal, you know? And I told him who he was and his band and everything else. And then, I don't know, a few months go by and everything, and all of a sudden, the radio's on. And I'm going, you know what? Who's that? Yeah. It sounds like I've heard that before, right? Yeah. Oh, it's a new group called Free. And I go, blah, blah, blah. Then when I started checking it out, I found out it was Paul, right? And I went, yes, that's it. Then they played around the clubs in London. Then I got to see him. And I went, buck of me, there you go. It's good to be right about things sometimes.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You get a real rush out of that, thinking that, you know, that it's right. Because it tells you that you're not totally wrong yourself,
right?
You
know? That's the story that people who like rock know, right, about Zeppelin.
Yeah, right.
You know, when I read about that, or when I first heard about it, you know, before I listened to your stuff, I'm like, of course that makes sense. And like, and then I'm like, did Robert Plant listen to you first? And there's that whole thing. But you know,
he says he did and everything else. Or whether he did before or after, it's not really important. The point was is that when I saw them, him and Bonham in that band of Joy, and Jimmy was looking for putting a band together, I went, that's it.
Yeah.
To me, it was just like, that's it.
But why'd you turn it down?
No, I didn't turn it down. This is the fucking thing that pisses me off.
I don't know.
I think Jimmy had air up his ass one day, way after Zeppelin was famous, right? Yeah. And all this, you know. And I think too many people ask him, why didn't you get Terry Reid in the band? Well, that would piss you off, wouldn't it?
Sure.
When you've got you're famous, you're double platinum, and you're still going on about this asshole Terry Reid, you know. I said, fuck Terry Reid. I don't fucking hear about him anymore, right? You know, he turned it down. How about that? Yeah. Right? And of course, everybody loves a train crash or an accident.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And they don't like the good story, whereas I got him the band together. That's one of them deals, right? So that's really the truth.
The story was you recommended.
I was going on tour with the Stones.
Yeah.
And the year.
Right.
Right? 69. Yeah. You know what I mean? Early 69.
Yeah, yeah.
So you think, well, and I said, well, call Keith.
Yeah.
Tell him I'm not going. And pay me what he's going to pay me. I don't have to do that. No, shoot you in the foot. You know.
But all these guys respected you. I mean, that's for sure.
The first tour I did with the Stones, with the Yardbirds were on it. I'd known Jimmy for years, in 65.
Yeah.
And I'd known him like with the Yardbirds thing as well.
Yeah.
And in that band was Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page.
Yeah, 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 it's crazy.
And they go solo and they both run forward.
Yeah.
Right? Well,
yeah.
That's how it started. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Double solos. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
No, it was horrendous, right?
Right.
They were louder. They were twice as loud as the Stones were. They were the only band that you could hear.
Jeff Beck is like a whole other.
Oh, no, he's iconic.
I have Billy Gibbons in here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's great.
He's great. Yeah. And he said that, you know, they opened for Hendrix in Texas.
Yeah.
And he said that that all Hendrix wanted to do, Hendrix had them deliver a stereo console to the hotel so he could sit in his room and try to figure out what the fuck Jeff Beck was doing.
That's Jimi Hendrix, right?
Yeah.
Jimmy's like that. I was very good friends with Jimmy.
Oh, yeah?
I know this all sounds ridiculous.
No, like, of course not.
Like I said to you earlier, I was right in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
And I'd known Jimmy for a while, just before it all bust open, you know, and went took off.
Yeah.
And he said to me before he came to England, before he went to England, I keep forgetting where I am. And he says, you know what? He says, you know Jeff Beck, right? I went, yeah, I know Jeff Beck. He says, you know Eric Clapton? I went, yeah. Oh, yeah, you know so-and-so, you know so-and-so. Yeah. I said, all guitar players.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to meet him, man. I love this style. Can't wait to play with him. I said, well, look, Jimmy, just slow up a minute. I said, so the way you play, I don't think it's going to be that easy.
Right.
He said, what do you mean? I said, well, when they hear you play, I don't think they're going to be too happy. But you know what? That's what happened. The first night he got up, I was there.
You were there too?
At the Bag of Nails, right? Or Scottish Bag of Nails in London.
Yeah.
He just got up with a group called The Gas, Billy Gas, right? And he got up and did Wild Thing.
Yeah.
Right. The Trogs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a little song that I know is close to your heart by one of your favorite groups. And we're all going like, right. And Chaz Chandler had invited everybody. It was like.
Chaz Chandler from The Animals?
Yeah. Well, he managed him.
Oh, okay.
See, so what happened was he'd invited Paul McCartney, invited Brian Jones and all this.
Richard Thompson said he was there.
Yeah. There you go. He invited everybody, right? Yeah. And I used to hang out there with me and Peter Jay. We'd go and have a few drinks there.
Yeah.
So we'd be there most of the time. Most of the time, we'd go there because it was empty.
Yeah.
Well, this one night we walked in, going, what the hell is going on?
Every musician in London was there.
Yeah, we knew everybody, right?
What, Townsend was there, probably?
Yeah, Townsend. Oh, everybody. Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, everybody.
Really?
Right. So halfway, he did Wild Thing, and he said, this is a lovely thing, your favorite group, Wild Thing.
Yeah.
Everybody went, yeah, Wild Thing? Were you nuts right there? Because everybody in England... The Trogs are nice guys, don't get me wrong. It was the group you love to hate.
Right.
You know, everybody does that, you know.
Was Jimmy taking the piss or was he doing
it? No, you heard him do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he took it to Planet.
And what happened?
Brian Jones comes running back to me and Peter Jay at the table.
Brian Jones does.
So, and he's hysterical, Brian.
Yeah.
He's a very funny guy.
Yeah.
So he comes running back. He goes, oh, you can't believe what it's like in the front. And I said, what? Why? He says, oh, the water, it's flooded in the front. I said, why? What do you mean? He says, oh, the guitar player's crying. It's terrible. I said, what are you going on about, right?
But he knew. Know,
some of them got, I won't mention who, got up and left.
No shit.
Yeah, it pissed them right off.
Really?
Well, they had it all right there in their fingertips, right?
Oh, they were on it.
They owned that whole rock guitar,
right?
Blues,
right?
Second generation, thing.
Right?
Now this brother turns up, right?
Yeah.
And just rips. I mean,
turns it inside out.
I still haven't heard anybody do what he does.
Yeah,
I watch him now on TV. I've told him, "Well, come on, I'll go." You know, you go through and it'll be like we did. I did the Georgia Festival, you know, Atlanta Pop Festival, 360,000 people. Right?
Yeah,
and that one he had the night and everything, right? And I remember that. And it was on, and I can't remember, well, which gig was that? Because we did a lot of them, right?
With him?
And I said, I did a lot. I did Yale University with him, right?
Yeah.
All sorts of gigs. And he pulled me in on things and that. It would be great. We were good friends, right? He's something else, and I'd be watching it. And then I see myself in the wings.
Yeah.
I go, oh, I know that gig. I remember it now. I usually go by what somebody wears. You remember what somebody wears.
Well, you know what's interesting is that, like, you know, in talking to you about it, like one of the things you forget about these guys who are long gone and you know, mythic figures
is that
you guys were out there doing the job. I mean, like gig after gig after gig.
Hell yeah. Oh, man, it never stopped for years.
You know? Yeah. And it's just like you forget that like it's not just the records. It's not just the idea of the guy. Oh, you guys were out there working.
Oh, hell yeah. Well, it's the only, I always say even now, the only peace and quiet I ever get is when we get on stage.
Yeah.
That's the only peace and quiet. That's the only peace I ever get is on stage because it's all the the traveling and the this and the bullshit.
Yeah.
And the monitor guy who you want to kill.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't got a clue. Well, I went to engineering school. Yeah, that was right. A waste of fucking money.
I can't hear myself. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a waste of money. You shouldn't have gone there. Oh, you're making a record. I see. And we're doing a live gig. Yes. Wonderful. Wonderful. Right?
Oh, my God.
And he still goes on.
I like that idea, though, that the only peace you get is when you get on stage. Yeah, because that's your time.
I swear. It is because you
it's
go.
Your space.
You go. Are we ready now?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, everybody. Here we go. Right. And then once you're in, they're screwed then. They can't do it. They can't go with it, right? So,
yeah.
You know.
So you and Jimmy spent a lot of time together.
Oh, yeah. He used to come and hang out at my house, you know, when it got too busy over at his.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's such a nice guy.
Sweet guy.
He could never tell people to leave.
Oh, really?
No.
Yeah.
He
just leave his health. He leave his own house.
He leave his own house. Of course, somebody got back and drunk everything.
Yeah.
But whatever, he didn't care, you know. He didn't care.
So let's talk about these. Where did you, like, because these, you did those four or five records early on.
Right.
And they're great records. They're beautiful records. They're unique records. And then sort of, you know, what happens? Like, how did you sort of sustain yourself, you know, after you just, you know, stopped making solo records?
Well, it's funny how things go. It's,
yeah.
You know, you had a lot of things happen. I won't say the industry.
Yeah.
I made some records I really enjoyed making. Like, yeah. River, I really enjoyed
making. It's a beautiful record.
I really enjoyed making Seed of Memory because I was working with Graham, my friend.
Yeah.
He said, let's make a record. Yeah. And I went, what do you mean? He says, us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you serious? I was in shock, right? And he says, yeah, leave it to me. We'll put it together.
It's a different type of record. It's a different production sound, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally different. Yeah, yeah. Totally different. You know, so, but the songs I'd written, I'd played him these songs and he loved them.
Yeah.
And that's the way they sounded, really, when I played them to him. And he helped me out get, you know, Ben Keith and Al Perkins. And
oh, and you work with David Lindley on the River. Oh, David Lindley, River,
that was another
River.
Band we had in England, you see.
He's a wizard,
this,
man.
This album that's coming out now, this album.
He's on that, yeah.
Right. Well, that's part, he was all over River.
Yeah.
And half of the album was done in England. And then the whole band broke up.
Mm.
David went with Jackson, right, mm-hmm. because Dr. Myers went number one. And we're on Atlantic, so you can't really argue. And Armin Ertegun was really good about it, right? And then Alan White, right, joined Yes.
Yeah.
With Eddie Offord, who was producing the album. So I went to Armin and said, well, we not only lost two members out of a four-piece group.
Yeah.
The producer ain't here. I mean, what do we? He says, oh, don't worry about it. He says, tell you what, you like California, right? I said, oh, I love it. He said, well, go, you look, I'll set it up for you. I'll find you a place to live. Get on a plane and get out here. He said, it's miserable over there.
Yeah.
I went, you know what? He's got a really good point there. It's pouring weather. It's freezing, right?
Yeah.
So it was just me and Lee Miles, the bass player, who had put that group together at the time, right? We fought for like 2 years to get it just how we wanted it, right? And we suddenly went, oh, okay. So Lee came over first, and then I said, I'm out of here. But I packed a bag and boom, I'd gone. I never went back.
To Britain, you never went back?
No, I've never lived in Britain since that, you know, when I...
Because Ahmed Ertegun told you to come.
Well, I to me, he was just...
Amazing,
he
right?
was the god of the record business. You ask anybody.
Sure.
It's not my necessarily opinion.
And then what
you'll never see the likes of that kind of musical... businessman. I just don't.
And he was nice to be around?
Oh, he's a riot. He's a funnest guy ever. He called you up, come and have lunch with me at the Beverly Hills, right?
Yeah.
I'm going, hang on, I don't think I'm dressed for it. Don't worry about that. Come on, just come in your shorts. Don't worry. I got the bungalow. They don't worry about us lot. I get there, he's in the smoke.
He loved jacket, rock guys, so, huh?
All day long, he'd sit there talking. Not necessarily about what you're doing. He would talk about music, ask your opinion on some act or something or this or that.
Oh, yeah?
And he's just like one of the band, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And did he, like, you know, after, because, I mean, you worked with a lot of other people, too, after the solo stuff, right?
Yeah. And now I'm working on this whole thing with Joe Perry.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, you know, because now from doing ballads and very sensitive things and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And Joe plays me this track that's just slamming to the wall, and so we wrote a song on it, and then we do another one that's like almost Turkish.
And you're singing, you're the front man?
Yeah, yeah, I'm singing it, yeah.
That's great,
and writing, man. And writing the lyrics and everything with him, you know, so it's great.
And what's it like to listen to, like, you know, this remastered... River outtakes. I mean, what's
oh, it's great. It's like memory lane.
Yeah.
All I see is 10 Brazilians in my house up in the countryside, all playing primitive instruments. Yeah. And a guy who lived in a village,
yeah,
go on his bicycle every morning to work.
Yeah.
Cluster. He come riding by my 400-year-old cottage that I lived in, and he come riding by about 7 in the morning,
yeah,
and they're all still going.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah,
like I've got yeah, a tribe of wild Indians from Bahia in my house.
Just and going, huh?
Yeah, it started getting around, like, yeah, what's going on over it? What's he doing now, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And what's the Deep Purple story, if we're going to do it?
Deep Purple?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't my thing. No. I've known Richie Blackmore for years and years. It was just not my brand paper. But, you know, I mean, it's, hey, to those around, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, look, Richie, thanks so much. I'm very flattered by it. You
yeah,
know? And the other singer, remember, like, who left, you know, would, I understand. I get the gist.
Yeah,
right, you know?
Yeah.
But that's how that happens to, you'll find if you'll interview a lot of singers.
Yeah.
A lot of people at that time in England, we call it the dartboard theory.
Yeah. You know?
Everybody was changing bands around.
Yeah.
And getting to see to get the winning combination.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
And knowing that English rock and roll bands had sort of made a very distinctive impression in America.
Yeah.
Like the hard metal bands and that, which became, you know, metal.
Like Sabbath.
And it was hard rock and yeah, Sabbath, you know, that. They,
yeah,
they'd sort of made the mold on that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they go, quick, let's get it together before somebody over there does it. Now, it's like heavy metal or whatever.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I find it interesting because now I've stuck around long enough to watch the young lads and what they do when they put a band together. Uh-huh. Now you've got mileage laws. You can only play here, but not for a couple of months in the same area.
Right, in terms
you
of touring.
New
right,
York
yeah,
is like 3 months. Right. I deal with that all the time. So I got wind of what happens. The young guys go, well, we'll have this band. And we'll call it that.
Yeah.
Then we'll swap a couple of members, get another name, and call it this. Then we go, well, I went, ah, you crafty buggers. I see what you're doing. Well, they're all going around. Well, is it the same? Well, no, it's not the same band.
Oh.
It's the same bloody band, but two people.
Right. So that's how
consortium.
They get around it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's, you know.
Uh-huh.
But also it's the thing. They're all the same thing, as I say, with the bands back then. They also are trying to find a winning combination.
Yeah.
But who's to, you know, I don't know if that. I think one of the best things to do, all the young bands out there, find a bunch of guys that you hate.
Yeah.
And then make a band, shut the fuck up, go on stage and play, yeah, and the cohesion will get you there.
Yeah.
Every successful band I've ever known hate each other's guts. I swear to you, you ask them, they all end up like trying to kill each other. You
really?
Know? Yeah.
Like the Who.
Oh, bloody hell. Well, he nearly pulled it off a few. Ask Roger. There's a few times he was worried about his own life, you know, with Mooney around.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You never know who he was going to blow up.
Right,
know?
Right. How was that? That guy must have been a...
Oh, no. He's dangerous.
Yeah.
He's very lovely. He's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
I know, we go out and do things.
Yeah.
There's hundreds of stories about Moon. And
yeah.
I've on the thing, I want to write a book, because the only way you can do this is...
Well, yeah.
The only thing long enough is a book that you can tell stories in.
Why don't you write a book?
I want to. Yeah, I want to. I just got to get somebody who's stupid like me that will listen. And write it down and understands my wonderful
There are guys
phonetics.
That'll do that.
Of course there are. I know more idiots than you could imagine.
Yeah,
right?
I read Keith's book. Keith's book's like the Bible. It's
yeah,
like 500 pages.
Yeah,
like,
you know what I mean? Well, once he starts telling stories, he's got way more than I'll ever have, you know.
But I couldn't believe it, you know, because with that book, like, you know, I grew up loving Keith, and like, you have these assumptions. Like, yeah, he's just this,
oh,
you know, like he's some junkie. And then you read that book, you're like, holy
oh,
shit.
Oh, no, he's as quick as a whip.
Oh, my God, he's bright.
Oh, he's
got
no.
ideas about
you
everything.
You don't live that long, right, without right. going around the corner.
That's right, that's right.
Nice.
So you want to play a song?
Yeah, sure.
So with that, okay, so the story on the new record is all the masters were at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And whose idea was it?
Now, what happened was I get a call from Matt Block from Warner Brothers. And he'd been set a task to go and get all the masters because, Warner Brothers bought EMI, right? And yeah, it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark ran there now.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got so much stuff. I mean, God bless them. I don't know how they're going to get through it.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, Jesus, it's a...
So there's a guy there now just going through shit?
I don't know. Because they sent Matt, who's in Chicago, over there to go through all the English, all the stuff that they got. Because all the, you know, it all gone back to a locker over there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly where. But it's all now Warner Brothers, so it all went to a Warner Brothers led locker somewhere.
Yeah.
So he says, so I went, okay, right. He gets on a plane, goes over. And he goes in this big locker and he looks up at this one shelf and it said Terry Reid on the third shelf, you know, above the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
You know, that's on the other shelf.
Yeah.
So I meant that respectfully. But
Sure.
But so he looks up and he goes, and he said, and he's like, Terry Reid. This whole row, right across the whole room of endless two-inch masters, you know, tapes.
Yeah.
And then a whole bunch with them of half-inch, you know, master mixes.
Yeah.
And he's going, oh, I've got my work cut out here. What the hell? So he starts putting them down, looking for the albums that were going to be on this four-box set that they pressed out a four-box set, right? A four-album box set. And so he found them, and as he's looking through, he's going, what is this? Right? There's another master and another and another and another mixes. So he thought, you know, while I'm at it, I think I'll go and play a couple of these and see what's on them. You know, you never know.
Right.
And he said it went on and on and on, and he found 24 pieces of material that he says, I was bopping away and groovy going... This Terry, what happened to this, right?
Yeah.
And so he called me up and said, I put them on a CD. I'm going to fly out to here to California. Have you heard them? I went, well, I did when I did them, but that's a long while ago. What are these? He said, well, a lot of them were just box titles because we didn't use them, so we never got that far. Yeah. So he came out and played them, and within a couple of coughs or a breath, into the beginning, I'd go, oh, I know what this is. And it all comes rushing back to you.
Yeah.
So, ironically enough, he said, well, I tell you what, I think you should put it out as an album. So we got together and worked it out with Light and the Attic in the end, right?
Yeah.
And voila. So now it's coming out, and they're all outtakes. This is just outtakes from The River.
Yeah.
These are outtakes from See the Memory, but not as many. It was a lot more concise working with Graham.
Anyway. All right, let's stick the cans on. Let's see if we can make this sound right.
Part I'm having trouble with life at the double part of me. That is a loving vow that only man has power to ordain. Every soul that comes in from the rain and wants to see, find someone, open up and tell these wild. Find that heart you're really yearning for, what you want to dream. Seems that your life's a scheme. Though you decide no more, I can see the floor in it. Don't even seem to ever be a part of what.
That is beautiful, man.
There you go. Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing it.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure.
Real honor to talk to you.
Oh, no.
Good luck with it, man.
Yeah.
That was exciting. A master, a great rock and tour, a great musician, a great singer, great life he's living. And I love that I did not sense any darkness or bitterness. And I'm telling you, even when he was having a smoke out there, I got a Mark Bolan story. I mean, I guess it could have went on for a while, but maybe I'll have him back, Terry Reid.
Boomer Live.